argument for the superiority of Jesus himself over angels and Moses, and the argument for the superiority of Jesus' work, his priesthood, his covenant, and his sacrifice. He's now appealing to them through a series of exhortations, and we looked last week at some of those things. We talked about his exhortation to hold fast the confession of our hope, to consider one another, to stir up love and good works. And of course, the way that he gave an example of that was to assemble together. We talked about how he warned about what would happen to those people who gave up on their faith, those people who rejected Jesus Christ, an even worse punishment than those people who rejected the law of Moses. And that punishment was death. And he says, how much worse punishment will there be if you reject the Son of God? And we finished looking at verses 32 through 34. We'll go back and ask for your comments here on that in just a second. But let's read Hebrews 10, verses 32 through 39. But recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle by both reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me and my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. We were discussing verses 32 through 34, where the writer talks to the people and reminds them about the great struggles that they had already endured. And I think his admonition to them was, you've done this before, now you're facing it again. I know you can do it because you've already done it. And we talked about how the way that they were able to endure that the first time, and the way that they were able to have to joyfully accept the plundering of their goods was because they had that eternal perspective, as he says in verse 34, an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. And just as the buzzer was ringing or beeping or whatever the buzzer does last week, I was saying that these verses 32 through 34 made an impression on me that he's writing to people who are actually not spiritual losers at all. They were actually very tough Christians, if that's a fair way to word it. Christians who had been through something more difficult than anything we've ever gone through, certainly, and had passed that test. And so that tells me how difficult the present situation must have been for them, because they'd already passed this test before. Now they're undergoing it again, and some of them apparently are giving in to it. And so, again, this book has gone over and over and over arguments that are similar, or even the same argument, over and over and over. Don't let this happen to you, and those warnings. Any comment or further comment on 32 through 34? Yeah, Chuck. That's a great point. And, you know, Satan didn't stop trying to get him to leave the faith after the first time, did he? You know, apparently, according to the writer, they won a great victory, but it's not over, right? Very good. Anybody else? Okay, verse 35, therefore, I think that therefore is referring to the last two topics that the writer has mentioned. I think he's saying, therefore, because you've already proven you've overcome persecution, and then back up a few verses, therefore, because we know about the punishment that God will render to those who reject Christ. So, therefore, because of those things, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. I really like the New American Standard and the English Standard Version. Do not throw away your confidence. Don't give up your trust in Jesus and the power of his word. And why should we have that confidence? Hebrews 7:25, a verse that we talked about at length a couple of weeks ago. I think this is the reason. Hebrews 7:25, therefore he is able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. And what is it that we're going to miss out on if we throw away our confidence, the great reward, right? Heaven, eternal life, the only thing we can work for that really matters. I want to ask you, we'll open this up for comments in just a minute, but I want to ask you, some of you guys have lived long enough, all of you live long enough probably, to see people who have thrown away their confidence. What kind of things do people, what kind of things cause people to give up, or what kind of things do people say cause them to give up their confidence, to give up their fight? Anybody want to comment on that? Say what? Supposed happiness, meaning that they want something in the world that they can't have. Yeah, very good. What else? Question, if God is real, does he not hear my prayer? Yeah, fantastic. What else? Emotional loss. Yeah. How could God let this happen to me? I thought about some things that some others, and honestly, I think these are all confidence problems, if you will. Some people get sick of politics in the church, right? Some people don't like what the preacher preaches on, disagree with the elder's decision. Somebody in the church has hurt them, and they can't get over it. Some people want their old life of sin back, as Matt alluded to. I think there's a common denominator there. People have their confidence in the wrong place, right? Their confidence is in anything and everything except for Jesus Christ. And let me suggest another reason. To some people, heaven seems unattainable. Maybe that's because they think their sin is too great, or maybe because the road is so long and difficult. But that's a confidence problem too, isn't it? It's a lack of confidence in the promises of God. And what I think the writer is saying here is that with God's help, and with our steadfastness, if we hold fast, we can do it. And I think we all need to hear that. And we all need to hear that on a regular basis. For you have need of, again, we'll ask for comments in just a second. For you have need of endurance, verse 36. Why do we need endurance? We need endurance because the road is long and difficult, right? I'm 41 years old and I'm tired of fighting Satan. I don't want to call any names, but some of you have been fighting Satan a whole lot longer than I have. Bruce, I'm picking on you again. It's probably laughable to you. You've probably been fighting Satan longer than I've, some of you longer than I've been alive. That's an insult. I didn't mean it. You know, I shouldn't have brought that up. I stick my foot in my mouth all day, every day. But the road is long. The journey is difficult. I bet you guys would say that, wouldn't you? Then why stick to it? It's right here in this verse. So that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. That's a beautiful thought. And if we can keep that in our minds, that's the key to endurance, isn't it? And when will that reward happen? When will we receive the promise? I want to read this section in, from Habakkuk 2, 3, and 4 from the New American Standard. I like the wording better in the New American Standard. So the Hebrew writer is quoting from Habakkuk chapter 2. For yet in a little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. This is talking about the second coming. Believe it or not, some people think this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem as this book was written before that event. But that doesn't make any sense, does it? Because if this encouragement was for these people to remain faithful, to endure until the destruction of Jerusalem, then what were they supposed to do after that? It just doesn't fit, does it? We'll take some comments if you want to disagree with that in just a second. But these people like us had to endure either till the time of their death or to the time of the second coming. This is when all of the faithful, right, will receive their reward. The New King James uses in verse 39 the term drawback to perdition. I like that fine, but I like the American Standard better, shrink back to destruction. It's easier for us to understand what that means, right? Shrink back. If you have a confident posture, I don't know if it's confident posture, but let's pretend it is. This is a posture that shrinks back, right? If you have a confident voice, maybe this is it. this is not so confident, right? You understand that. So I like shrink back. I like shrink back better. It's easy for us to understand. We're going to live by faith because of our confidence in the promise. And that faith, verse 39, leads to the saving or preserving of the soul. Last thing on these verses, and then we'll open it up. I mentioned last week that the impression that these verses have made on me about us being people of encouragement. And this chapter teaches us we need each other's help to hold fast the confession of our hope, verse 23, to have faith the preserving of the soul, verse 39. These are the kind of things we need to be saying to each other. I don't know how often we do, but I think we do. Things like this, you can do it. You remember that last time or those other times when you won the battle against Satan? I know you can do it again. Or things like, don't throw away your confidence. Don't throw away your confidence, which has great reward. Or things like, if you endure, you will receive the promise. And I really, really, really love verse 39. We are not of those who shrink back to destruction. Have you thought about that? Sometimes we need to say to each other, that's not who we are, and we're not going to do that. Questions or comments on 32 through 39? Yeah, that's... Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Who else? Yeah.
My whole life I've learned and studied a lot of Hebrews 11, what a powerful chapter we've got to get into. But the writer of Hebrews is the power of chapter 11 comes from what we're studying right here.
That's right. Yeah, this is fantastic. The tie-in between 10 and 11 is, I'm with you on that. I don't know if I spent enough time on that in my life, but it's fantastic. I told Ashley, we were talking about this last week, and I told Bob, I think I'm the luckiest substitute teacher that ever lived. Bob needs me for 2 weeks. We're in Hebrews 10 and 11. Matt needed me last month, 2 Thessalonians 1. I'm like, come on, whoever's next quarter, bring it, okay? I'm ready. Who else on 32 through 39? These verses are fantastic. Yeah.
He is trying to convince them that this is a marathon, not a sprint. There are things that are going to happen. And the one who made the promise, they're having to realize that Jesus, who is our sacrifice, is alive, will be alive whenever that judgment comes. And in 2
Yeah, and I love 2 Peter 3, you know, the Lord's not slack concerning his promise. We're about to get into chapter 11. That's really what faith is. If you want to just boil it down, There are those people that believe and trust the promises of God, and there are those that don't. Yeah, who else? Okay, guys. Chapter 11 is one that we're no doubt familiar with, as Ashley has said. We've heard countless lessons from the pulpit. We've sat in numerous Bible classes, and rightfully so. As a tie-in to chapter 10, the writer's exhorting his readers, right, at the end of chapter 10, enduring to the end and receiving the promise cannot happen without this faith that Habakkuk has talked about. Without that faith, you're going to fall back. You're going to shrink back because the pressure is too great. And it's if he stops in his exhortation to them to give them a discourse on faith. He's going to talk about the nature of faith. He's going to talk about the effects of faith in the lives of people who have it. And his object is to show that faith, which is really just confidence in the divine promises, has always been the means of salvation, right? And it doesn't matter if a person lived before the old law, during the old law, or in these last days. Trust in the promises of God that leads to obedience is what has always saved and what will always save. And because of that, it's kind of difficult to overstate the value of this chapter. You know, we could probably study it every night till the rest of our lives, and that wouldn't be too much. There are lots of ways for us to try to define faith practically. And one, I love the definition of faith in verse 6, which we'll get to a little bit later. But I think what we see in this chapter is that if we have faith, we trust and obey. And it really is that simple. We have confidence in God's promises, and because of that confidence, we obey. No questions asked, because God is who He is, and we are who we are. And as has been pointed out over and over and over and over, the people of faith in this chapter acted, right? There is no faith without action. Any comment on that before we get into the text? Okay, look at the first three verses first. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. Verse 1, somebody, if you don't mind, read for us from either the New American Standard or the English Standard. Verse 1. Who's got that? Ashley? The assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So the substance is what the New King James says, or the assurance of things hoped for, as Ashley just read. That's the firm persuasion, right? Isn't it? It's the substantiation of the reality of the blessings hoped for as a result of God's promises. How can we be assured, this is a question for you, how can we be assured that what we hope for based on God's promises is certain? I don't mean that to be a trick question. Does that sound like a trick question? How can we be sure? Say it again. God doesn't lie. He's always kept His promises. That's really all I was going for there. We can be sure of that because there's never been a promise that God hasn't kept. It's also the evidence or the conviction of things not seen. It's a full confidence that the things we've not seen are real, right? God, Jesus Christ, heaven, afterlife. How can we have full confidence that things we can't see exist? Somebody want to tackle that one? Because what we can see. And that goes back to what it's saying in verse 3. But because of what we can see. That's Romans 1:20, right? That's Psalm 19, verses 1 through 3. Because of the things that we do see that tell us without doubt that there is a Creator. Anybody else on that? Verse 1. That's a great example. I know you couldn't hear Bill over there. Bill said, there's a McDonald's wrapper laying on the ground and there's nothing in it. And the guy says, well, what do you think was in this wrapper? Well, it was a cheeseburger. Well, how do you know that? Right? It's the evidence that McDonald's made the cheeseburger. I like that, Bill. Bill sounds just like Bob when he's talking, by the way, does he not? Should have let you teach, yeah. Verse 2, for by it the elders obtained a good testimony. I think the concept there, maybe a better concept or better way to understand it, is talking about the ancients, basically these people who have gone before. By it they obtained a good testimony. It's talking about these heroes of faith, right? This faith is how they please God. Again, these are people mentioned in this chapter that live both before the old law and during the old law. Verse 3, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God. We understand that, right? God literally spoke everything into existence so that the things which are seen are not made of things which are visible. That's pretty understandable, right? God didn't make what we can see. Okay, look, you know what I'm trying to say. All right, God didn't make the universe out of material we can see. That's what I'm trying to say. Any comment on 1 through 3? The essence of faith. Chuck. Faith starts with God created. Fantastic. Anybody else? Yeah. There's substance to the promise. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, fantastic. I didn't mean to hate on New King James, by the way. Anybody else? Okay, let's look at 4 through 7. I don't see any way we're going to get past this. May not make it past 4, right? By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts. And through it, he being dead, still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Looking at Abel first, what was it that Abel did by faith? What did he do? Yeah. That's exactly right. That's fantastic. And that's what Abel did. He took him at his word. He did exactly what he asked for. Abel offered the correct offering with the correct attitude because he understood who God was. And what was the difference between his and Cain's? I don't know. Maybe it was animal versus fruit. Maybe it was the best of what Abel had versus not the best of what Cain had. Maybe it was the attitude and not giving God his just due that got Cain. I don't know. And I'm not really sure that the Bible tells that. But it's very interesting that it says, through that sacrifice, he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts. And I don't know exactly what that looked like, but it was made clear to Abel by God that his sacrifice and his person was pleasing, and that Cain and Cain's sacrifice and his person were not pleasing. Genesis 4 and verse 4 and 5 says this, "And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." The person who sacrifices and the sacrifice itself are accepted or rejected together. That's extremely important. That's extremely important. There is no such thing as being acceptable to God, but offering unacceptable sacrifices to God. And I think that that's a big deal in the religious world today. And let me say this on Abel, then we'll get some comments. How does Abel, well, I'll ask you this. How does Abel speak to us? Through it, he being dead still speaks. So what does that mean? Raise your hand if you've given a Wednesday night talk on this. I think about half the room has. I mean, I definitely have. What does it mean? Ashley. That's fantastic. You know, none of us are going to have our lives recorded in the Bible, right? So we're not going to speak to everybody for thousands of years like Abel has. But understand that every single one of us is leaving a legacy. And we're leaving a legacy in our families, in this church, in the people that we work with, in our communities. And if that doesn't give you a lump in your throat, it probably should. What kind of legacy am I leaving, and who is going to be faithful on down the line because of what I've done? That's extremely important. Anybody else on Abel? Verse 5. What do we know about Enoch? How many Bible verses talk about Enoch? There aren't that many. He's actually mentioned in Jude. I didn't even realize this, I don't guess, until just the other day. Jude 14 calls Enoch a prophet. Other than that, we know basically this, and that Enoch walked with God, Genesis chapter 5, and that God took him. He's a favorite Bible trivia question, right? Who are the two people that never died, right? Enoch and Elijah, right? Used to get that trivia question all the time when I was a kid. Anyway, Enoch walked with God. I love this, though, because we know almost nothing about his life. It's almost like Ashley was saying about Abel. We know next to nothing about Enoch, but we know that he obeyed. And the only way he could have obeyed, back to what many others have said, is that he knew God for who he was and he trusted what he said. Anybody comment about Enoch? I feel like I've insulted you enough already, so I guess, you know, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but how about endurance? We don't need near as much endurance as those guys did, do we? Verse 6, I love the way this verse looks at faith. First of all, without faith, it's impossible to please him. Well, why is that? That kind of seems like a rhetorical question, doesn't it? If you don't believe God's who he says he is, if you don't have confidence that he'll do what he says he'll do, you got no reason to obey him, right? That's the whole issue. So, of course, without faith, you can't please God. For the person that comes to God must believe that he is, that is, that he exists, and, not or, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Strong's defines diligently as the idea of searching out or craving or demanding. Maybe in our vernacular we'd say something like getting after it. It's the idea of giving every effort to learn what God wants from us and then doing it. But it seems like a lot of people want to cut out the second part of this verse, right? That all we really need for God to save us is to believe that He is. Like the rest of the verse doesn't exist. But just the people surrounding these verses, the faithful people in this chapter, they certainly didn't stop at just believing that God exists, right? They took that to obedience. I'm convinced Cain believed God exists, aren't you? Cain offered God a sacrifice. I'm pretty sure he believed God exists. But he certainly fell short of diligently seeking Him, either by his sacrifice or by his character or both. And so I think this is a great verse, maybe even one of the best ones, to help us see that belief alone is not enough. Anybody with a question or comment on verse 6? Don't you wonder what it would be like to be in the position of those guys? I tell myself, you know, if I was in that position, there's no way. There's no way I wouldn't trust and obey. There's no way. And yet a whole bunch of them didn't. Is it possible to be so selfish that you even know some of that and just don't care? Yeah. That's great. Let's take a look at verse 7. And we can certainly go back to any of these comments that you want to. What did Noah do by faith? Noah did something totally unprecedented, didn't he? God warned him, this verse says, of things not yet seen. Do you kind of have your own personal ranking of things done by faith, maybe in this chapter or elsewhere? Maybe you got Abraham at number one for offering his son Isaac in your own rankings. I'd have a hard time arguing with you there, but I think I might have Noah at number one. God told Noah there's going to be a great flood, going to destroy everything on the earth. Totally unprecedented, right? He told him to build a gigantic ark that was going to take years to build. Totally unprecedented. While everyone on the entire earth literally was telling him how stupid he was. I don't know if Noah ever doubted along the way, but I do know this. He was, according to this verse, moved with godly fear to prepare an ark for the saving of his household. This story is just amazing to me. Yeah. Without equal. Got to be crazy. That's right. Oh, yeah. I can't imagine what that was like. It's amazing. Let me make a couple more things, and then Bob will probably talk about this for a long time next week. But first of all, as a side note, we talked a little bit about fear versus reverence last week. I want you to know that the Greek word in this verse for fear is different than the Greek word used in verse 10 and verse 31. The Greek word that's used in verse 10 and verse 31 has the connotation of frightened or alarmed or afraid. We are to be afraid of what God will do to us if we turn our back on Him. This Greek word is more about reverence, right? Noah had a respect for who God is and knew that when God spoke, it was going to happen. In fact, the New American Standard says in reverence, that Noah in reverence prepared an ark, and the English Standard says in reverent fear constructed an ark. Secondly, how did Noah condemn the world? Some people say Noah condemned the world by the building of the ark itself, and that basically because the ark took so long to build, that Noah took all the excuses away from the wicked, that they saw what he was doing and they had plenty of time to repent of their sins. That sounds good, but I don't think that's what the writer is saying. This chapter is about faith, right? I think Noah condemned the world by his faith. And if we had time, we'd read this, Matthew 12, in the same way that the men of Nineveh rose up and condemned the people in Jesus' generation, in the same way that the queen of the south rose up and condemned the people in Jesus' generation, right? That's Matthew 12, 41 and 42. Everybody who gives heed to God's warning and admonition condemns all those other people who don't by their belief and action. And I think that's what's getting at that Noah did. And finally, you gonna ring the bell on me? Finally, the righteousness that comes by faith. I love this. Noah became heir of the righteousness that's according to faith. He acquired, he gained, he became a possessor of the righteousness connected by faith. Well, how did he do that? He had faith in Jesus? Of course not. He had no idea who Jesus was, right? Noah believed God that there would be a flood, and he had confidence in God's promise to save him if he obeyed, even though what was he was being asked to do was unheard of. In other words, as we've been saying, he knew the character of God and had complete trust in him. And I'll give you a couple of things to think on as we close. Hebrews 10:38, which we just read a little while ago, Romans 1:17, quotation from Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by faith. Also in Romans chapter 4, talking about Abraham, this is the same concept as Abraham. Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Verses 20 through 22 of Romans 4 tell us exactly what that means. Let me just read you this quote very quickly. How was Abraham's belief counted him to righteousness? It says, he did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, and finally, he was fully convinced that what he had promised he was able to perform. That's the essence of faith, guys. Thanks a lot.